Welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for Thursday, March 11th. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Tribune reporter Julian Aguilar is sitting in for Ben Philpott this week. Hi, Julian.
Hi, how you doing?
Today we are talking about Bill White and his appearance, his long, lengthy talk with Evan during Trib Live this week, legislative races, the ones to watch, border issues, and Karl Rove. Does anyone like him anymore? Evan, we'll start with Bill White and your talk.
Well, I don't know if anybody likes him anymore. I assume people do. I'm glad he's in the first slot, at least, and not in the last slot of this podcast. Mayor White was really very interesting, I thought, in the hot seat yesterday. He was candid about the areas of difference with Governor Perry, as you'd expect him to be. He was feisty. He was I think, pretty forthright on a number of big topics. And I think the most important thing about Mayor White was that we see that this is not going to be a cakewalk for the governor. I think that Mayor White intends to marshal every argument against the governor. He intends to raise clearly every area of difference with the governor, and he's going to do everything he can to make this a race. Now, whether it inevitably can be a race, whether the math is there for it to be a competitive race or not, he's going to do everything he possibly can. He talked about Soviet-style budgeting, the fact that the—
Right. He had some good lines.
Good lines that Perry and Strauss and Dewhurst had required the state agencies to all cut 5%. He made an argument, I thought a pretty good argument, whether you agree with it or not. It was he made a real stab at it, that you can't expect the same thing from every agency. Certain agencies are harder to cut than others, and if you just require the same thing from everybody, that's a bad thing. He talked about hot air politics.
He was going to try to avoid hot air politics, which is kind of itself an example of hot air politics, but it was a good line.
Yeah, it was a good line. We're still talking about it. He would not allow himself to be pinned down on the tax question, which I think is going to be something that we'll be hearing about a lot now. The Perry people picked right up on that this morning, that Mayor White would not commit to not raising taxes as a way out of the budget shortfall.
This is one of those simple things. I mean, you know, the reporter, you in this case, reaches over, pulls the cover off the manhole, and the candidate walks into the manhole. It was one of those, you know, it was one of the basic questions you get at the first of a campaign is there any circumstance under which you'd raise evil taxes? And, you know, the candidate's political response, you know, basically has to be no. And
the better thing to do is to say no now, and then later, when circumstances dictate that you veer from that,
just say tax.
Say then, yeah. Well, at the time that I gave the answer, I didn't think it was going to be necessary, but things have gotten worse, or I found out stuff I didn't know. But to hold the door open to the possibility is essentially handing a billy club to the people who want to make you into this caricature.
Well, and it's such a classic thing. It happens over and over and over again. I mean, 20 years ago, Clayton Williams in the Republican primary said that, well, I don't want to rule out an income tax because I'm not sure exactly what we're going to need to do once we get in there. They're facing a budget deficit just like they are now. He's going into a race. The next day, Ken Hance took his face off. The next day, Clayton Williams said, under no circumstances would I approve an income tax. Right. I mean, we'll go through a really quick cycle on it. It was just sort of interesting to watch White step in that particular hole because it's such a standard early campaign question.
He couldn't have expected not to get that question. I mean, that's an obvious question you ask candidates at this stage.
But he answered it just as I expected him to answer it. That's what he was faced with the exact same question when he was running for mayor, and he answered the same way, and then, as he said, wound up cutting taxes. And so, I mean, I obviously not smart politically, but White, I think, in essence, is asking or is challenging voters to be a little bit smarter. The problem is that he's in a position where he's explaining
You know what's smart politically is, frankly, candor, even if the candor ultimately gets you into trouble. I think being candid people like. I think people appreciate that.
Yeah, so conventional wisdom is like, whoa, you know, yikes, and that was my initial reaction. But I guess if you think about it for a little while longer, you can appreciate the substance of the answer.
I'm going to be surprised if he didn't walk this one back. I think he's going to walk himself out of this tax question.
What was your reaction?
Well, I had a question for Evan. What did you make of his reaction to you asking him about his trial lawyer status?
Well, he wasn't very happy with me for asking that, was he?
He kind of so funny.
But, you know, I'm a big boy. I can handle it. Look, he correctly identified him, New Hampshire political consultant Dave Carney criticized the mayor for being a trial lawyer, which is, you know, in the mayor's, I'm going to paraphrase what the mayor said, basically, true but not accurate. True in the sense that, yes, he is a lawyer who, you know, will take on cases that you could characterize technically as, you know, making him a trial lawyer. But he says, I don't really represent ambulance chasers. I don't represent the kind of people who pursue the kinds of action that caused the tort reform movement to rise up in the state. And he actually kind of attacked back at me for daring to raise it as a journalist, which is, of course, right. ludicrous.
How dare you be a journalist and ask me questions?
Oh, yeah. You can't ask that. but, you know, I mean, look, the mayor has to know, Julian, the mayor has got to know that the Perry campaign is looking to road test at this point the attacks that will be most successful. Is trial lawyer going to work? Is anti-gun going to work? They brought up Sanctuary City, which is something that the mayor and I did not talk about yesterday, mm-hmm. but they used that. They referred to him as a Bill Clinton protege in this memo. We talked about President Clinton.
Right.
He didn't give, I thought, a terribly sufficient answer or terribly complete answer as to, you know, would you talk about President Clinton during the campaign? Well, I'll talk about my work as deputy energy secretary. Yes, but if they seek to run an ad of you, a photograph of you and President Clinton, is this going to be a problem for you in a state like Texas? I tried to get him to talk about Obama, and he kind of, well, I disagree with some things the president does. I agree with other things the president does.
Actually,
he has to know.
That was actually one of his better answers.
You thought so?
Yeah. He did the thing where he said, you know, I support the president. You know, my family prays for every president when they're in office, Bush and Obama right. and everything. I disagree with this guy on, he said,
spending
on the federal deficit, on, you know, the way he's handling the economy.
Well, what do you disagree with the president on, Mr. Mayor? Everything. Well, what spending don't you like? All of it. Well,
right.
You know, okay. Here's the question.
But I thought that was the better political answer.
What I want to know, though, is what will happen if the White House calls down to the mayor's office, to the campaign office, and says, the president considers the opportunity to pick off Rick Perry to be one of the party's priorities in this election cycle, and the president would like to come to Texas or is willing to come to Texas to campaign with you. What happens then?
I think that call, you know, these guys are in politics. They know how to ask that question. They'll say, would it help if we would come down, or would it help you more if we stayed here?
And the answer from the mayor's campaign will be,
stay in Washington. Go to Chicago, have a nice vacation in Hawaii.
Right. Play basketball with somebody in another state.
Lone Star State, right.
But don't show up here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Look, I think the mayor held his own. Let's just say that. He held his own. He lived up to the billing of he lived up to his own billing in the sense that the race needs to live up to its billing. I said before he joined us on stage yesterday that this was fixing to be the most competitive race for governor since Bush and Richards in 94. He did nothing yesterday to dissuade me from thinking that. I thought that he showed himself to be, you know, he'll be tough, and I think he'll be substantive and we'll let the people decide.
That said, I think this race is positioned a little bit high. I think I don't know anybody who would call a white win anything but an upset. Charlie Cook's got this as a toss-up state.
Well, not just Charlie Cook,
Rothenberg,
Larry Sabato and all those
guys. Well, Stu Rothenberg has it as lean Republican.
But they're all saying that Perry is more vulnerable than he's been in previous races.
Relative to other races, I think that's right. I think White's the most competitive Democrat. I think a Democratic win in this governor's race is going to be an upset. I think, you know, the way to bet is on Perry at this point.
Can I ask Julian a question? So from the standpoint of the border and the Latino community having to decide where to go in this race, does White automatically get the vote in the Valley, say, just because he's a Democrat? Or, I mean, I wonder about the degree to which the Hispanic vote will be a factor in this race. Perry likes to brag, as Bush liked to brag, that they tend to do better with the Hispanic vote than most Republican politicians do.
I think it depends.
What do you think?
I think it depends on what the GOP does. They're making an effort to say, you know, traditionally Hispanic culture is more in line with GOP values as far as their anti-abortion stance and, you know, some of the things that they kind of pulls them together. And I think that's what the GOP might try to do in the Valley. But if you had to call it right now, I think that Bill White would still get the nod down there. As we all were reminded, you know, the primary, the Democratic primary pretty much is the election in a lot of these districts found in the Valley and on the border.
Yeah.
So I think if that holds true, then I don't think Bill White would have a problem taking those counties down there unless we all see it differently.
Is he the kind of candidate that excites a vote? I mean, there or anywhere else. I mean, this is the question about Bill White. Is there enough Elvis here to get people off their couch into the voting booth in the Valley or in Dallas or in Wichita Falls or wherever?
Well, in the Valley, a lot of the voters really turn out in the primary, though, more than they do so in the general, if the general isn't very exciting, right? Like non-presidential years, I would see a lot of action actually on the primary end instead of the general end because it's a largely Democratic area, right?
Yeah, and he can't take it for granted. I mean, he's got to realize that. He's got to look at voter turnout for the general election versus the primary, and he's got to go down there and really make an effort, which some people say he's already done. He's been to Laredo a few times. He's been down to the Valley a few times. This was before the primary, but I think if he wants to keep that momentum going, he's going to need to travel down there a lot more.
And it's a math problem, which we tried to get into at the end yesterday with the mayor, that he's going to have to get every vote he possibly can to make this a truly competitive race. And if the Hispanic community is not energized, I mean, forget about Elvis. You know, I think the Democrats would take fat Elvis at this point.
Right.
It doesn't even have to be skinny Elvis. It could be fat Elvis. He has to have some kind of Elvis.
Right.
If he can't somehow become exciting enough to attract those folks, get those folks out, he needs to count on the base Democratic vote, of which the Valley voters are definitely a part.
Two or three of the top vote-producing counties for Democrats in any statewide races are Cameron and Hidalgo. And, you know, you got to have them. They don't produce for Republicans. If the Democrats going to win, they have to produce down there.
How much will Linda Chavez-Thompson being the lieutenant governor nominee help?
It should help some. I mean, you know, it certainly doesn't hurt. I mean, there's two females. Help me here. There's two females on the Democratic ballot.
Chavez-Thompson and Radnofsky.
And Radnofsky, who's running against Greg Abbott. She's the only Hispanic. No, Hector Uribe is on the ballot as well.
Hector Uribe is on the ballot, that's right.
You know, in that classic sort of Democratic sense, it's a balanced ticket that way. I don't know whether that produces votes or not. I mean, if they see it as competitive, people go to car wrecks, right, to go see, you know, what happened down there. And political races are the same way. You get a really exciting race in 2008 between Obama and Clinton here. People show up in a Democratic primary. You get a pretty good Republican primary this year between Perry and Hutchison. People show up in the primary. I think it has something to do with the names, but it has more to do with the competitiveness of the races.
Now, White claimed that there was he talked about at least one K voter who had come over to him since the primary. And I think obviously the White campaign has to hope that there are a bunch of K people who just look at the idea of voting for Perry and they go, ick. And they think, I'll vote for this guy instead. But, you know, you build a campaign around that supposition, that's a tough deal.
They're both playing for November voters. Perry will get the Republicans, White will get the Democrats, and it's the people that vote in November and don't vote in party primaries that they're fighting for.
Let's talk more about November, the races you think everybody ought to watch.
You know, there's only a dozen. I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. There are 181 members of the Texas legislature. There's 32 members of Congress. There's about 12 races. You know, when we're at the end of a decade, so redistricting has pretty much settled the maps. Most of the Republican districts are held by Republican incumbents, most of the Democratic districts by Democratic incumbents. And there's not a lot of change. There's about a dozen races where people will really fight. And really the bottom line of this, there's kind of two things to watch here. One of them is there's not enough races around the state that the races in the legislative part of the ballot are going to drive local turnout. So it's not like you're going to go to the polls because there's a great fight for state senate, and then you'll also vote for governor, or you'll also vote for Linda Chavez-Thompson or for David Dewhurst or whoever. The other thing is that the races, however they come out, probably won't change the nature, the political standing of either the congressional delegation, the state senate, or the Texas House. So,
except the lobbyist class is really, I guess it's because they miss Tom Craddock and they miss all the intrigue of it. A lot of my lobbyist sources talk a lot about, does the Phil King, you know, Craddock faction, did they pick up enough new members?
This is the idea that conservative Republicans,
yeah, that there's going to be another challenge to Strauss.
Well, and in fact, wasn't there some gathering at Warren Chisholm's ranch?
That's the rumor.
Chisholm flat denies this, and I can't find anybody who says I was there. You know, so you know it's a. You know, it's like Voldemort, you know,
right.
It's like we're in a Harry Potter book all of a sudden, number eight. I don't think that there's anything to it. I mean, you have to elect a bunch of Republicans from the conservative side of the Republican spectrum in order to even talk about this. You have to find some well of dissatisfaction against Joe Strauss that I don't think he's had time to build up. He's only been speaker for a year. I don't think he's done anything really to make anybody mad enough at him to mount an insurrection. And I also think that there's nothing that would more quickly unite the Democrats in the Texas House than the prospect of a rise of the right wing of the Republican Party again.
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of unify that block vote. That's what the lobby's doing, but I think that's a non-starter.
If the only thing that entertains me between now and November is the number of times I get to say Haldenwang, it's going to be a long year, I'll tell you what. Look, I think the races that you identified in the Tribune this morning, Ross, are all good races, and they're all interesting races. And
yeah,
as you said, you know, Republicans hold the Republican seats, Democrats hold the Democratic seats, and the Republican seats that Democrats are now holding are not surprisingly the ones that are on the bubble.
Right.
Right? You got a lot of seats, Miklos and Turner and Kent and
The two that the Republicans think that they just own and will consider themselves failures if they don't get back are the Maldonado seat in Round Rock. And this is Deanna Maldonado, who won what had been a Republican seat for a dozen years in Round Rock, Williamson County, just north of Austin. And Christy Tebow, who won a seat in kind of the old suburban part of Houston. There's this kind of phenomenon in urban areas where the older suburbs are now trending back to the Democrats and the newer exurbs are becoming more strongly Republican. So in Dallas, that's the Richardsons and the Garlands and the Mesquites that are going a little bit more Democratic. The Planos and the Van Alsteins and the McKinneys are staying very solidly Republican. You know, it kind of works like that. In Houston, Christy Tebow won this race from Jim Murphy. The Republicans think it's their district. The Democrats say, no, the demographics of this have changed sufficiently that this is really a Democratic seat. She won in 2008. The Republicans think it was part of the Obama surge. And, you know, the fact is that the first time after you upset the other party, they'll come back at you just to see if it was a fluke or if it was a real race. And so they're going to come at Tebow and Maldonado for sure.
And if you survive that first challenge, often you're pretty good.
Right.
Which is why I'm curious that you have Linda Bolton on the list, because Bolton has now escaped defeat.
In 08. That was the Obama year. That district is still seen as kind of an exurb.
Her margin slipped in a year when the Democrats were surging, and the Republicans went, huh, that's interesting. And so now they're back for more. I think that's a competitive district. I think that's one of those districts that it could go either way. But I think it would really help the Republicans if Bolton had made some serious political mistake in the last legislature or the one before that, and she didn't. So,
is she better off if Holly Turner wins or loses the runoff?
I don't know. The two people in the runoff here are Holly Turner
and Paul Workman.
Holly Turner's husband is Chris Turner, a Republican political consultant, so she's got free
fire. As opposed to the Chris Turner, who's a Democratic House member.
Right, free firepower at home. I don't know which is the more dangerous matchup to Bolton. I think it's really her seat to lose unless the Republicans really have a sort of remarkably good year, like a watershed year. It's a coin toss district.
Wait, whose seat to lose? Bolton's or
it's
Turner's?
It's Bolton's to lose, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's one, like you mentioned, she's a battle-hardened, she's defended this seat a couple of times.
Well, can we talk, before we move on to Julian's topic, can we talk about Averitt?
This is the weirdest. I love races like this.
So when we last turned into—
Waco has produced yet more news for us.
We last tuned into, as the Averitt turns, the legislative soap opera set in Waco, he has now announced his resignation, but it's not entirely clear that he's resigning? Like, what— Dude, make a decision.
There's two things here. So Kip Averitt decided after the filing deadline that he didn't want to be the senator next time. It was too late to get off the ballot. He declined to campaign. There's a guy named Darren Yancey up in Burleson who really wanted the seat. Is from a much more conservative part of the party, kind of a Tea Party candidate, a little bit he's to the right of Averitt, certainly. And Averitt won the race in spite of the fact that he didn't campaign 60%. So he's got the nomination. He says he will not take the nomination. So the first thing he did was he resigned from the Senate and said, they're going to have a special election to replace me for the remainder of my term, which runs through next January. Yancey has already said he'll sign up for that. David Sibley, the former senator, Averitt's former boss, says he will run for it. Whoever wins that election probably—
Sibley has now announced. He's not just flirting with it.
He has not announced.
He's not.
He has announced that he is interested in that people I meet when I walk down the street are talking to me. He's kind of in that
state. Well, it's Waco. Right? Of course they're talking to you.
Yeah, right.
Come on.
Yeah. He's taller than all the rest of them.
Right.
So they're going to have a May 8th election. The winner of that gets to serve through the end of the year. At that point, Averitt probably says, okay, now I don't want the nomination officially. And the 10 county chairs in the district—
So hold it. So he can resign from the Senate without resigning from the nomination.
Right. He's still on the ballot.
This is
okay, so the
weird.
Second piece is resigning. Yeah, it's weird. It's great. It's, something to make podcasts go. So when he resigns from the nomination, then it's up to the 10 county Republican chairs to vote amongst themselves and pick somebody for the nomination. And the theory here is that they'll come in after this May 8th special election and say, well, so-and-so won the May 8th election. The voters have spoken. Let's put that person on the ballot. But they don't have to.
Yeah. So what if so-and-so doesn't win?
What if so-and-so doesn't win, right? Well, they don't have to honor the—they're not bound to the May 8th election.
But if so-and-so does win, and then they decide to have somebody else, they can do that too.
Right. So there's a lot of politics going on. This is the classic backroom politics. It's great. They don't smoke in there anymore, but, you know, it's the clear-skied backrooms.
And the Waco, this is viewed by Waco as we need to protect our seat.
Yeah, the two growth counties here are Johnson and Ellis counties, which are basically Dallas-Fort Worth suburban counties, and that's where the population is. Waco's had this seat for years. Redistricting's coming up in the next legislature. Waco business interests of both the Republican and the Democratic stripe would like to hang on to this seat for Waco, because once it goes away from Waco, it's never going to come back. It'll always be in Burleson or, you know, Ennis or, you know, someplace else.
All right, since we went on the Averitt detour, Julian and I can just riff together on Rove. Basically, the premise of my question is, you know, Rove is back out with this book where he's trying to kind of, I guess, partly pay penance for any mistakes that he might have made while between 2005, 2008, or maybe even before, and then maybe kind of clear up his record, too. But I read this interesting story in the Daily Beast that basically posits that nobody likes Karl Rove anymore. Even his friend, who is the head of CPAC, was kind of like, don't come this year, you know. We don't really want to sully things with reminders of 05 to 08.
So what's the timing then? Why now? Why is he reemerging?
Well, I mean, I suppose that it takes a while to write a book, you know? I mean, some of it is just the practical.
I'm writing in here. I've been writing and writing.
Right. And then, you know, it is actually really interesting timing because he was privately supporting Kay Bailey Hutchison, who suffered this nasty loss last week. So, you know. Is the luster kind of off Karl Rove?
Is the bloom off the Rove, basically?
There's our headline writer right there.
The blossom off the turd.
We'll now assign a story on the basis of the headline, regardless of whether there's a story.
You know, the Rove thing is interesting. I mean, you know, he hangs a lot of the faults of, you know, the Valerie Plame thing on Bob Novak, who, you know, conveniently is not here to defend himself. He died last year. It's interesting watching the Republicans sort of write the history of the Republicans of the last 8 years, and that's really what we're watching, is that, you know, the people in the administration on this side are writing their book, and the people on that side are writing their book, and 20 or 30 years from now, someone will go through all these books and kind of sort it out, and we'll get the real history. But this is kind of the first blush, everybody sort of trying to plant their flag and saying, you know, this is the official Rove history of the Bush administration. We're going to get the official Bush history of the Bush administration here pretty soon.
We already got the official Tom Pawkin history, which we're running on the Tribune site this week.
Came out the day before the Rove history.
Which is, hated it. That's pretty much the whole book. You know, and that's the kind of interesting part to me, is that there's internecine feuds in places you didn't expect them to be.
Right.
I never read Scott McClellan's. Did you read that one? Because I'm curious to see, you know, what kind of sandbagging was going on in there.
Well, that's what I say. I mean, you know, at some point somebody's going to do sort of the average book on the Bush administration. It's like, I've read these 20 books. Here's the mix-up. You know, the mashup's going to be very interesting.
The summary of the books.
Right, right. Yeah. So,
how much attention is this book going to get outside of Texas, outside of the small little political
circle? I bet it'll be pretty big. I think that Rove will probably make a few bucks on this book. Don't you?
Wayne Slater was on Rachel Maddow last night talking about it. So
Rove's a big name. He was a player in this stuff, whether you like him or not. In fact, the fact that you like him or not and probably do whatever you do passionately probably helps sell
the
these books.
The fact that you have an opinion as opposed to, you right. know, let's just say that the Andy Card book would not be on the bestseller list. I would not be eagerly refreshing my Kindle to get the Andy Card book.
Right.
But the Rove book, which, by the way, is not on the Kindle.
It's not.
And I'm annoyed.
There was some controversy about it.
Well, you know, he's
sort of a techie nerd.
The Halperin Heilman book was also not available on the Kindle initially, and I think this is to drive hardcover book sales.
This was game change.
And eventually they'll release the book on the Kindle or an audio book, which, you know, could be read by, I don't know who, you know. That might be an interesting Tribune contest. Name the most interesting person to read the Rove book as an audiobook, and you'll win, yes, a hat.
Oh, who should be the voice?
Who should be the voice of Karl Rove? Because Dennis Boutsakaris, the character actor whose name you don't know but whose face you surely do, is the person who read Game Change. I listened to it as an audiobook, and it was a very pleasurable experience to hear that.
All right, Evan has decreed the new Tribune contest. Julian, I thought it was very interesting that you wrote about what was going on in the Port Isabel Detention Center this week. Tell us a little bit about what this protest is all about.
Well, they're protesting the fact that the inmates inside are being treated like prisoners, like criminals, and not immigration detainees. And it was interesting, Ross and I were talking about it this morning on the Facebook page, the story, the little snippet. The comments automatically assumed that these were criminals from Mexico, from Central America, that are put in these facilities. And they're actually legal residents, immigrants from everywhere else, from the Congo, from Antigua, from
Canada. God forbid.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That was the only border jumper, and you know, they got
the right. Of hockey, right?
Yeah. And what they're protesting is that they, within 50 miles of each other, were the Willacy County Detention Facility, which is managed by a private company out of Utah, and the Port Isabel, which is an ICE facility. Combined, they probably have 4,000 detainees in there, and this is in a very rural part of South Texas. And while they are allowed to retain counsel, it's not guaranteed. They're not appointed to them, so they have a lot of trouble getting these legal resources, which I think is where a lot of the frustration stems from. Not to mention the allegations of what they say goes on inside these prison facilities, which is that these guards go through very little training. And the training that they do doesn't really address how to handle a population that's inside a prison, inside a detention center. So they allege that they're being mistreated. And the only way that they can really get some attention is to go on these hunger strikes and to get the word out to their families. And they allege that once the word gets out to these family members that you know, phone numbers are blocked and the media is muzzled. They can't go in and, you know, get these visits as often as they do. So that, you know, coupled with them not being able to get legal representation, or what they perceive to be is no access to legal representation, just it's really a powder keg, just ready to go off.
And one of the things that they were saying was that if you're a prisoner in here and you protest, that one of the responses is to move you to another place, further from your family, further from kind of the outside support system.
Punish you for protesting.
Sure. Right. If you are lucky enough to have an attorney where your case originated, I was speaking to somebody from whose fiance was arrested in Miami and wound up in Port Isabel. That's one thing that she said. She said, "Look, I've heard that they're pretty much, you know, like union busing, I guess. You know, spreading them out over here and spreading them out over here. That these people that were on this pact together, some of them were sent down to Carn City, which is a GEO-run facility. Everybody knows GEO. It used to be Whack and HUD, one of the most notorious private prison companies out there. They've been, you know, up and down the court system and they've been punished for some of these egregious acts that go on inside their facilities. But you know, that's part of what they say is the punishment, that if they try to protest, then they'll just get splintered out everywhere along the country, which makes it even harder for them to communicate with anybody on the outside.
I just like the fact that the government refers to these hunger strikes as voluntary fasting. That's right. Like out of Frank Luntz.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about just
we've done this with a focus group, and we've decided to call it. Right.
Exactly. Non-eating.
Sure.
Right. I mean, how ridiculous is that? That's crazy. And I also thought, Julian, to your reference to the Tribune's Facebook page, which posted the story, and then the links were just execrable. They were just horrible. Uh-huh. And it was people making the most base racist assumptions about who was in these facilities.
Sure.
You want to understand the polarization and the immigration debate, you read the comments of that story.
Right. And that's a larger issue also, is that they were promised some reform to the immigration detention system, and that those reforms haven't happened. And some of this reform was addressing access to legal representation and, you know, better training for the staff.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes hand in hand with immigration reform, whatever happened to immigration reform.
Got back burnered.
I guess so.
Well, yeah. I bet it comes back somehow.
That's what Lindsey Graham is actually. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, is actually criticizing President Obama today for forgetting immigration reform and
on the slate card for the, you know, John Cornyn, the senator from Texas, does these weekly conversations on the phone with reporters, and it's on the slate card for that today. So immigration's back.
Yeah, the talking points are there.
All right. Well, thanks, Julian, for sitting in. And on behalf of Ross
and
Evan, my name is Elise. Thank you for listening.